Line, an essentially secret society, almost like the Freemasons, although it became more open over time, its mysterious origins and secretive overtones derived in part from the earlier suppression of unions. Although the Knights of Labor was not the first national labor organization, it claimed the title and grew the most rapidly. Powderly's strategy involved enlisting everyone, skilled, unskilled, farmers, in order to make the union as large as possible. By 1886, the Knights numbered more than 700,000, and they successfully struck the Denver Union Pacific Railroads and achieved their greatest victory with a strike against Jay Gould's Missouri, Kansas, Texas, and Wabash Railroads, as well as the related Missouri Pacific. In the face of such disciplined opposition, Gould had to rescind the pay cuts he had made earlier. Even so, the violence turned the public against the strikers, cost the Knights a massive loss of membership, and killed the union. Another incident associated with labor violence occurred at Chicago's Haymarket Square in 1886, where the Knights protested at the McCormick Reaper Works for an 8-hour day. On May 3rd, 200 policemen were watching an angry but still orderly crowd of 6,000 when the workday ended and strikebreakers left the plant. As the strikers converged on them, the police assumed the worst and began clubbing and shooting the strikers. Calling for a new mass meeting on May 4th, radical editors like August Spies set the table for more violence. Revenge! Working men to arms! Your masters sent out their bloodhounds! At the meeting the next day, a bomb exploded, killing 7 policemen and leaving more than 60 wounded, and the city was placed under martial law for what became known as the Haymarket Riot. Subsequent trials produced evidence that anarchists only loosely associated with the Knights had been involved, although most were recent German immigrants who had generally brought their radical socialist ideas with them from Europe, but a jury nevertheless convicted 8 Knights of murder. Governor John Peter Altgeld, in 1893, pardoned 3 of the men. Haymarket, combined with the violence of the strikes, ended the Knights as a force in organized labor, as well as the anarchist threat in America. But they appear to have peaked anyway. Powderly's strategy of admitting anyone could not succeed in sustaining strikes by the highly skilled workers on behalf of the unskilled, and farmers never had a clear role in the organization. A more powerful and effective union movement came out of the efforts of a former Knight, Samuel Gompers, who in 1886 founded a rival union, the American Federation of Labor, AFL. Like Carnegie, he had started his career at age 13, moving to New York from London, where he had been born into a family of Dutch Jews. Karl Marx, another Jewish refugee, arrived in London the year before Gompers was born. While still a boy in England, Gompers had watched his father work as a cigar maker, and he became enamored of the union organization, seeing it as the locus of social interaction and security. Indeed, even before he left for America, Samuel Gompers treated the union as a creed or a religion. Unlike many laborers, though, Gompers acquired a broad education, learning the rudiments of several languages, the basics of geography and politics, and even dabbling in logic and ethical philosophy. He arrived in New York City in the middle of the Civil War, disembarking only a few weeks after the draft riots there. Working his way through the cigar makers' union, Gompers came to reject the radical ideologies of the socialists. On one occasion, he grew so agitated by a socialist diatribe that he grabbed the speaker by the throat with the intent to kill him, only to be dragged off by other patrons. Gompers rejected socialism, often voicing his anger at agitators who he knew had never set foot on a shop floor. For Gompers, pragmatism had become the objective. "We are fighting only for immediate objects," he told the U.S. Senate, by which he meant his staples of wages and hours. By 1877, when he took over as president of the New York local, he was a stocky man with a thick handlebar mustache. Already he had surpassed Powderly as a strategist on a number of levels. He could drink with his fellow workers on the shop floor one moment and negotiate boundaries between rival shops the next. He understood that the strength of the unions lay in the skilled labor and craft unions, not in the unskilled masses. Above all, he kept his eye on the ball, wages and hours. Gompers also kept American unions, in theory at least, apolitical. This was common sense, given the small percentage of trade unionists in the country, who by 1880 accounted for less than 2.3% of the non-farm labor force. For employees to have power, he believed, they had to be organized, strike infrequently and only for the most significant of objectives, and maintain perfect discipline. Work stoppages, in opposition to the introduction of new machinery, not only were ineffective, but they also ran against the tide of history and human progress. In addition, uncoordinated strikes, especially when the unions had not properly prepared a war chest to see the members through the lean times, were worse than ineffective, posing the threat of destroying the union altogether. Gompers knew hardship firsthand. In the 1877 strike, Gompers, with six children, pawned everything he had except his wife's wedding ring, and the family had nothing to eat but a soup of flour, water, salt, and pepper. Even though that strike failed, it convinced Gompers more than ever that a unified and prepared union could succeed. Equally important, Gompers had accidentally hit upon the Confederation structure, which allowed employees of new and evolving industries to join the organization essentially with equality to the established trades, thus allowing continued growth and development rather than a calcification around aging and soon-to-be obsolete enterprises. What Gompers and his unions did not endorse were third-party movements, since he appreciated the winner-take-all, single-member district structure of American politics. Specifically, for Gompers, that meant avoiding the new populist movement, despite its appeal and the populist leaders' efforts at recruiting among the unions. Raise less corn and more hell. Farm organization efforts began as early as 1867 with the founding of the Patrons of Husbandry, more popularly known as the Grangers. Grange chapters spread rapidly, gaining momentum until the Grange had a membership of 1.5 million by 1874. Originally seen as a means to promote farm cooperatives, facilitating the purchase and sales of other farmers' products at lower prices, the Grange soon engaged in political lobbying on behalf of various regulations aimed at railroads and grain elevators. The Grangers managed to pass laws in five states that were challenged by the railroad and elevator owners, including the partners in a Chicago warehouse firm, Ira Y. Munn and George Scott. In the Munn versus Illinois case, where the Illinois Supreme Court held that the state legislature had broad powers to fix prices on everything from cab fares to bread prices. Munn and Scott were found guilty by an Illinois court of fixing prices, and Munn appealed, arguing that any arbitrary definition by the state about what constituted a maximum price violated the Constitution's Takings Clause and the Fifth and Fourteenth Amendments. The Supreme Court held that states could regulate property for the public good under the police powers provisions if it could be shown that the enterprise in question benefited from its public context. Unfortunately, the court did not consider the state's evidence that grain elevators had constituted a monopoly, and it ruled exclusively on the appeal of state authority to regulate. This left open the question of whether a business that happened to lack natural competition due to geography or the choice of others not to compete was violating the law simply by existing. The Grangers had already moved into a political activism that peaked with the election of 1880, and they soon faded, replaced by the Farmers' Alliances. This movement emphasized similar cooperative efforts, but also stressed mainstream political participation and organization. Led by a host of colorful characters, including Mary Elizabeth Lease, a Kansas schoolteacher and lawyer famous for her recommendation that farmers should raise less corn and more hell, the Alliance sought to appeal to blacks to widen its base. White Southerners, however, never supported the Colored Farmers Alliance, and it disappeared within a few years. Meanwhile, every move to expand the appeal of the agrarians to one group, such as the freedmen, alienated other races or ethnic groups. Despite the flamboyance of characters like Lease and Sockless Jerry Simpson, it was Charles W. McCune, the Alliance president, who formulated a genuine political plan of action. McCune advocated government loans monetized by the issue of new greenbacks or other types of government legal tender notes, thus inflating the currency. The idea of inflation, either by the monetization of silver or through creation of new fiat money issued by the government, took on a life of its own as the end-all of agrarian unrest. Farmers, sharecroppers, and any of the southern or western poor, for that matter, had become indoctrinated by pamphlets and incessant speeches that the solution to their problems was merely more money, with little instruction about the ramifications of money creation at the government level. William Coyne Harvey, for example, in his popular book, Coyne's Financial School, 1894, offered a conspiratorial worldview of a money system controlled by sinister, often Jewish, bankers who, like the octopus, a favorite conspiracy symbol, had their tentacles throughout the international banking system. Other conspiracy-oriented books included Seven Financial Conspiracies Which Have Enslaved the American People by Sarah E. V. Emery, 1887, and Mary Lease's The Problem of Civilization Solved, 1895, which raised the specter of both international banking cartels and racial pollution as the cause of American farmers' plight. In these scenarios, the Rothschilds and other Jews of Europe, operating through a nebulous network in London, sometimes with the aid of the Bank of England and Wall Street, conspired to contract the money supply to benefit the lending classes. The developments surrounding the silver and money issue in the late 19th century originated with an international deflation that set in during the 1870s, but were in no way the work of the Rothschilds or other allegedly nefarious groups. These international forces were largely hidden from domestic critics and inflationists, who thought that increasing wage levels allowed them to pay back fixed debts with increasingly cheap dollars. They ignored the fact that all other prices rise and that although mortgages may stay constant, the price of seed, tools, farm implements, clothing, and fuel increases, eating up whatever savings are gained through the temporary artificial advantage in the mortgage payments. Nevertheless, at the time, the postbellum policies of the U.S. government appeared to cause agrarian and labor distress. It began with Congress's 1873 decision not to monetize silver, but to resume redemption of the Civil War-era greenbacks in 1879, putting the country on a de facto gold standard. This followed a decade's worth of increased silver production, originating with the Comstock lode in 1859, that had changed the ratio of exchange between silver and gold. Gold became more expensive, but the cheaper, more abundant silver was more widely available. This seemed to offer an opportunity for government action. If the government could be forced to purchase silver at fixed prices, higher than the market price, and coin it, silver miners would receive artificial price increases, and new silver coins would flood the West and South, providing a solution, it was thought, to the money question. When Congress rejected this scenario, silverites labeled the action the Crime of 73. Meanwhile, the Treasury, under John Sherman, had carefully accumulated enough gold that the resumption occurred smoothly. Prior to the resumption, pressures from Westerners and Southerners to counteract the slow deflation that had gripped the economy led to calls for new issues of greenbacks. Alliance-related greenbackers even succeeded in electing 44 congressmen sympathetic to the movement and 4 pro-alliance governors in the years preceding 1892. The farmers increasingly found their calls for regulation and control of business drowned out by a larger new coalition of Westerners and Southerners who wanted the monetization of silver as the cure to all agrarian ills. Since the early 1870s, worldwide deflationary pressures had forced prices down. Farm prices fell more than others, or so it seemed. Actually, it depended entirely on the crop as to whether prices genuinely dropped or stayed relatively even with other products. Despite the roundly criticized crime, the U.S. government had little impact on the price level, except when it came to banknotes. Since the Civil War, national banks had been the sole sources of note issue in the United States. That meant that notes tended to be more plentiful where there were many national banks, and less so where there were fewer. Both the South and the West were at a disadvantage in that case, the South because the controller of the currency was unlikely to give a bank charter to either former Confederates or freedmen, and the West because of the sparse population. Each region clamored for more money. When the Western silver mines proved richer than even the original prospectors had dreamed, both regions saw silver as a means to address the shortfall. In 1878, Richard Silver Dick Bland of Missouri and William Allison of Iowa introduced a measure for free and unlimited coinage of silver at a ratio of 16 silver ounces for 1 gold ounce. Fearing a veto from President Hayes, Allison introduced amendments that limited the total silver purchased to $4 million per month at market prices. Allison's amendments essentially took the teeth from the bill by robbing it of its artificial advantages for the holders of silver. Nevertheless, it reflected the new West-South coalition around free silver, meaning the purchase of all the Western silver that could be mined, and its coinage at the inflated rate of 16 ounces of silver to every ounce of gold. This was stated in the parlance of the day as 16 to 1, when the real relationship between silver and gold was 17 to 1. Put another way, silverites would be subsidized at taxpayers' expense. By Grover Cleveland's time, the federal mints had coined 215 million silver dollars, with more than 3/4 of them in government vaults and only $50 million in actual circulation. Meanwhile, as miners hauled more silver into exchange for gold, the government saw its gold supply dwindle steadily. Had the government circulated all the silver coins, it would not have produced prosperity but inflation. Prices on existing goods would have gone up, but there would have been no new incentive to produce new goods. Instead, a different problem arose. The government had to pay gold to its creditors, mostly foreign, but had to accept the less valuable silver from its debtors. Congress formed into 2 camps, one around free silver, intending to increase the silver purchases and push for full bimetallism, and another around the gold standard. Cleveland was in the latter group. With a hostile president and enough gold bugs in the House and Senate to prevent veto overrides, the silver issue stalled throughout the remainder of Cleveland's term. But it would resurface with a vengeance under Harrison. Shame of the cities. While farmers agitated over silver, another large group of people, immigrants, flooded into the seaport cities in search of a new life. Occasionally, they were fleeced or organized by local politicians when they arrived. Often, they melted into the American pot by starting businesses, shaping the culture, and transforming urban areas. In the process, the cities lost their antebellum identities, becoming true centers of commerce, arts, and the economy, as well as hotbeds of crime, corruption, and degeneracy. a serious menace to our civilization, warned the Reverend Josiah Strong in 1885. The cities, he intoned, were where the forces of evil are massed, and they were under attack by the demoralizing and pauperizing power of the saloons and their debauching influence in politics, not to mention the population whose character was so largely foreign and where Romanism finds its chief strength. The clergyman probably underestimated the decay. In 1873, within 3 miles of New York's City Hall, one survey counted more than 400 brothels housing 10 times that number of prostitutes. Such illicit behavior coincided with the highest alcohol consumption levels since the turn of the century, or a quart of whiskey a week for every adult American. As the new wave of immigrants arrived, so too a new concept, that of the melting pot, so named for a 1908 play by Israel Zangwill and derived from the ideas presented in Hector St. John de Crèvecoeur's 1792 Letters from an American Farmer. The idea proposed that ethnic groups and immigrants lost their cultural identities and melted into a single homogeneous stew of Americanism. Yet Crèvecoeur's melting pot really had only included English, Scots, Irish, French, Dutch, Germans, and Swedes, and these groups came overwhelmingly from countries that were grounded in Christianity, particularly Protestantism and Western law and traditions. Newer arrivals were not nearly so homogeneous, and indeed many came from parts of the world where revolution was the norm, with little regard for constitutions or rights. Some members of these groups refused to melt at all, forming the basis for radical socialist and anarchist minorities that sought to remake America into a version of themselves. Some level of social and political pathology was inevitable in any population, but it was exacerbated by the gigantic size of the cities. By the 1850s, the more partisan of the cities, especially New York and Boston, achieved growth in spite of the graft of the machines and the hooliganism. New York, the largest American city after 1820, Chicago, Philadelphia, and Boston emerged as commercial hubs, with a second tier of cities, including New Orleans, Cincinnati, Providence, Atlanta, Richmond, Pittsburgh, and Cleveland, developing strong urban areas of their own. But New York, Boston, Chicago, and New Orleans especially also benefited from being regional money centers, further accelerating their influence by bringing to the cities herds of accountants, bankers, lawyers, and related professionals. By the mid-1800s, multi-story buildings were commonplace, predating the pure skyscraper conceived by Louis Sullivan in 1890. Even before then, by mid-century, two-story developments and multi-use buildings done in the London style had proliferated. These warehouses and factories soon yielded to larger structures made of brick, such as the Montauk buildings of Chicago in 1882, or combinations of masonry hung on a metal structure. Then, after Andrew Carnegie managed to produce good, cheap steel, buildings were constructed out of that metal. More than a few stories, however, required another invention, the electric safety brake-equipped elevator conceived by Elisha Otis. After Otis demonstrated his safety brake in 1887, tall buildings with convenient access proliferated, including the Burnham and Root, Adler and Sullivan, and Hollabird and Roche buildings in Chicago, all of which featured steel frames. Large buildings not only housed businesses, but also entertainments. The Chicago Auditorium, 1890, was 10 stories high and included a hotel. After 1893, the Chicago city government prohibited buildings of more than 10 stories, a prohibition that lasted for several decades. If the cities of the late 1800s fulfilled Jefferson's worst nightmares, they might have been worse had the crime and graft not been constrained by a new religious awakening. Intellectuals, Reform, and the Foundations of Progressivism. The Age of Reform, as historian Richard Hofstadter put it, bloomed at the turn of the century, but it owed its heritage to the intellectuals of the 1880s reform movements. These reformers embodied a worldview that saw man as inherently perfectible. Only his environment, especially the roles cast on him by society, prevented him or her from obtaining that perfect state. Whereas many of the intellectuals of the late 19th century came from mainstream Christian religions, few, if any, traced their roots to the more fundamentalist doctrines of the Baptists or traditional Methodists. Instead, they were the intellectual heirs of Emerson and Unitarianism, but with a decidedly secular bent. Reformer Jane Addams, for example, had a Quaker background, but absorbed little Christianity. "Christ doesn't help me in the least," she claimed. After her father died and she fell into a horrendous depression, Addams gained no support from Christianity. "When I am needing something more, I find myself approaching a crisis and look rather wistfully to my friends for help." Henry Demarest Lloyd, whose series of Atlantic Monthly articles in 1881 made him the original muckraker, was born to be a Dutch Reformed minister turned bookseller. Lloyd himself was religious, though well-educated, at Columbia. Like most of the early reformers, he had received a first-class education. Indeed, reformers almost always came from families of wealthy means and were people who seldom experienced hardship firsthand. Mabel Dodge Luhan, the daughter of a Buffalo banker, attended all the best schools before coming to the conclusion that she could not trust her thoughts, only her senses. Lincoln Steffens's father was an affluent merchant who could afford to send his son to universities in Europe, where he acquired a taste for expensive clothes and dabbled in philosophy and aesthetics. Upton Sinclair and Jack London proved exceptions to this rule. Sinclair's family came from wealth on his mother's side, but Sinclair's father, a ruined former Southern aristocrat, had descended into alcoholism and supported the family by selling liquor, then hats. Unlike most of the other reformer intellectuals, Sinclair actually worked, selling dime novels to put himself through Columbia University before turning out the muckraker's call to arms, The Jungle. London, a socialist, adventurer, sailor, gold seeker, and famous novelist whose Call of the Wild became a classic, had grown up poor and had, as a youth, worked a wide range of jobs. More typical than either of these writers was Ida Tarbell, considered the original muckraker, whose father, Franklin, had a thriving oil tank building business, providing her with a first-class education at the Sorbonne. Another aspect of the social gospelers is worth mentioning here. With some 2 to 3 million fathers absent from the home during the Civil War and hundreds of thousands of fathers dead, literally millions of young boys were raised in households of women. Rather than learning masculine behaviors, they had been raised by mothers who taught nurturing and caring, in the process turning boys to the ways of their mothers and took Christianity out of the home to save the world. It is not a stretch to suggest that the casualty lists of Gettysburg and Chancellorsville produced a feminized, progressive worldview among the emerging generation of reformers. Best known for his association with the phrase social Darwinism, scholar William Graham Sumner, who taught the first true sociology course in the United States, professed views that were slightly more complicated. Writing in The Independent in 1887, Sumner identified the central threat to the nation as plutocracy, which was controlled by the wealthy who had the bourgeois tastes of the middle class. Embracing Malthusian views of overpopulation, Sumner expressed concern for the negative impact of charity and government policy, arguing in his Forgotten Man character, introduced in his 1884 book, what the social classes owe to each other. The danger was as follows. The type and formula of most schemes of philanthropy or humanitarianism is this. A and B put their heads together to decide what C shall be made to do for D. The radical vice of all these schemes, from a sociological point of view, is that C is not allowed a voice in the matter, and his position, character, and interests, as well as the ultimate effects on society through C's interests, are entirely overlooked. I call C the forgotten man. Benevolence, he argued, stole resources from those who would actually use funds to improve the lot of all in society. Every bit of capital, he argued, which is given to a shiftless and inefficient member of society who makes no return for it, is diverted from a reproductive use. But if it was put into reproductive use, it would have to be granted in wages to an efficient and productive laborer. What the social classes owed to each other was to not create new impediments to the natural laws and laissez-faire capitalism that already functioned well. Critics latched on to Sumner's phrases, such as the competition for life and struggle to apply the natural science ideas of natural selection advanced by Charles Darwin. Yet Sumner had specifically warned against plutocracy and acquisition for its own sake. To Sumner, social classes best helped each other by performing their tasks with efficiency honed by competition. That did not stop Sinclair from claiming that Sumner took ghoulish delight in glorifying commercialism, or prevent historian Richard Hofstadter from calling Sumner a social Darwinist in his 1944 book, Social Darwinism in American Thought. Like other intellectuals and academics, Sumner ultimately relied on a scientific view of human behavior to explain and defend policy. And like other intellectuals and academics who at one time had as their central purpose the search for truth, Sumner had, at least in part, taken on the new vocation of social moralist. The emergence of this class was a phenomenon made possible only by the fantastic productive capabilities of capitalism, which provided the time and goods to allow people, essentially, to think for a living. Grover Cleveland, Presidential Giant. Perhaps because his terms were separated by the administration of the opposing party under Benjamin Harrison, or perhaps because he simply refrained from the massive types of executive intervention that so attract modern big government-oriented scholars, Grover Cleveland has been pushed well down the list of greatness in American presidents as measured by most modern surveys. Although in older polls of historians, he routinely ranked in the top 10. Republicans have ignored him because he was a Democrat. Democrats downplayed his administration because he governed like a modern Republican. Uncle Jumbo, as his nephews called him, had served as mayor of Buffalo, New York in 1881, and the following year won election as governor of the state. Cleveland's rise to prominence was nothing short of meteoric. He claimed the mayorship of Buffalo, the governorship of New York, and the presidency within a 4-year period. Cleveland's image has enjoyed a revival in the late 20th century because of new interest by conservative and libertarian scholars who see in him one of the few presidents whose every action seemed to be genuinely dictated by constitutional principle. He was the last president to answer the White House door himself or to write the checks to pay the White House bills. Displaying a willingness to completely disregard either public opinion or congressional influence to do what he thought morally and constitutionally right, Cleveland supported the Dawes Severalty Act, which turned out to be disastrous and alienated many in his own party through his loyalty to the gold standard. A man whose personal character, like that of his friend, New York rival Theodore Roosevelt, stood above all other considerations, Cleveland repeatedly squelched attempts by outsiders to influence his policies for political favors. Above all, Cleveland saw himself as the guardian of the people's money. He fought to reduce the tariff and to whittle down the pension system that had bloated government balance sheets. Cultivating a reputation in New York as the veto governor, Cleveland peppered every veto, whether to the legislators in Albany or later to their counterparts in Washington, with principled reasons for not acting based on a Beardian class-based reading of the Constitution. It must be remembered, however, that the federal government of Cleveland's era, leaving aside the pensioners and the post office, was tiny by modern comparisons. Congress did not have even a single clerk in 1856, and 15 years later, Grant operated the executive branch of government with a staff of 3 assistants. The total federal bureaucracy, even including the post office and customs inspectors, numbered only about 50,000. In the election of 1884, Cleveland won a narrow victory over Republican James G. Blaine of Maine, 219 to 182 electoral votes, and 4.875 million to 4.852 million in the popular vote. A mere 600 votes in crucial New York would have given the election to Blaine. The campaign had been one of the dirtiest in American history. Blaine supporters accused Cleveland of coming from the party of rum, Romanism, and rebellion, referring to the perceived affinity between immigrants and alcohol, the Catholicism of many Democratic voters, and the Confederacy. The charges backfired on the Republicans by propelling Irish and Italians to the polls in large numbers. Blaine's troops also sought to tar Cleveland with the charge that he had fathered an illegitimate child, generating the slogan, "Ma, Ma, where's my pa?" This related to a child named Oscar born to Maria Halpin, who she said belonged to Cleveland. The governor had never denied possibly fathering the child, but the woman's record of promiscuity allowed for any of several men to be the father. At any rate, Cleveland agreed to provide for the boy and eventually arranged for the child's adoption after the mother drifted into drunkenness and insanity. He never maintained contact with the boy or even met him again after the adoption. In any event, the charges had failed to gain traction with the voters. Blaine, a notorious spoilsman, wallowed in spoils like a rhinoceros at a pool, complained New York Evening Post editor Lawrence Godkin. In contrast, when a man approached the Cleveland camp about purchasing documents that proved Blaine had had an affair, Cleveland bought the documents, then promptly destroyed them in front of the man, who nevertheless tried to peddle the story to the papers. Cleveland was not perfect. Like Rockefeller, he had purchased a substitute during the Civil War, making him the first draft dodger president, no matter the legality of the purchase. Nevertheless, draft evasion never seemed to damage Cleveland. Once in office, Cleveland announced he would enforce the Pendleton Act scrupulously, finding allies in the new reform wing of the Republican Party. If anyone appreciated Henry Adams's criticisms of legislators, "You can't use tact with a congressman. A congressman is a hog. You must take a stick and hit him on the snout." It was Cleveland. When he assumed office, he found a system corrupt to the core. Temporary employees were shifted from job to job within the administration in what was called rotation, rather than eliminate unneeded positions. This put a completely new twist on the Jacksonian concept of rotation in office. Customs collectors, postal officials, and other federal bureaucrats recycled thousands of people through the system in this manner. When one clerk making $1,800 was released, 3 more temporary employees making $600 each were hired, while the original employee went into a queue to be rehired. What made his reforms stick was the fact that Cleveland imposed the same standards on his own party as on the Republicans, who had just been kicked out of office. Only once did a delegation of Democrats approach Cleveland about tossing a capable Republican from a position in order to fill it with a member of their own party, and the president dismissed them. No battle demonstrated more clearly Cleveland's determination to combat corruption in government than the fight over pensions, in which he took on a key part of the Republican voting bloc, the Grand Army of the Republic, GAR. Founded by B.F. Stevenson in 1866, this veterans organization had quickly become the most powerful special interest lobbying group in the United States. Membership was limited to those who had served during the Civil War, and although the GAR had built soldiers' homes and managed to have Memorial Day declared a national holiday, the organization's main raison d'etre consisted of increasing the value of pensions and expanding the number of those eligible for Civil War pensions. Although eligibility for the pensions was supposedly restricted to those suffering from disabilities in military service, congressmen encouraged fraud by introducing private pension bills for constituents. Presidents, not wishing to alienate voters, simply signed off on the legislation. Until Cleveland, who not only inspected the claims, but also rejected 3 out of 4. One claimant had broken his leg picking dandelions, yet wanted a government pension. Another had a heart problem 14 years after the war's end. And another wanted recompense for injuries received 23 years before the war from the explosion of a 4th of July cannon. Still others had deserted or mustered out with no evidence of disability until long after the war, when Congress opened the federal treasury. By confronting the pension question head-on, Cleveland addressed an outrageous scandal, but one cloaked in the rhetoric of the war. In 1866, just over 125,000 veterans received pensions, accounting for an annual total of $13.5 million from the Treasury. But 7 years later, the numbers had risen to 238,411, despite the fact that many of the pensioners were getting older and should have been dying off. Supported by, indeed agitated by, the GAR, pensioners lobbied Congress for ever-widening definitions of who was a veteran and to make provisions for widows, orphans, and ultimately even Confederate veterans. When the pension numbers finally began to decline, which should have occurred in the 1870s, Congress introduced the Arrears of Pensions Act, which allowed claimants to discover wounds or diseases, then file retroactively for pension benefits that had been granted when they served. Men who suffered an attack of fever while on active duty became convinced the fever was in fact the root cause of every ill they suffered since separation from the service, observed Cleveland's biographer. New claims shot up from 19,000 per year to 19,000 per month. Cleveland would have none of it. He had no reluctance to give legitimate pensioners what was due them, but he considered most of the claims an outrage. Congress had learned to enact special pension bills late on Friday nights. On one night alone, the Senate enacted 400 special pension grants. Worse, each bill required that Cleveland sign or veto it personally. This absorbed monumental amounts of the president's time and energy. Cleveland had enough and vetoed as many as he could, finally delivering the death blow to the bogus pension system in 1887. His veto of the so-called Blair Bill, which represented a massive expansion of federal benefits, was sustained. After that, a chastened Congress submitted no more pension legislation. In 1888, the Republicans nominated Benjamin Harrison, the grandson of William Henry Harrison, and the second of 4 pairs of family presidents: the Adamses, the Harrisons, the Roosevelts, and the Bushes. Little Ben stood 5 feet 6 inches tall, was strong yet chubby, and grew up on a farm. He attended Miami University of Ohio, the Yale of the West, then settled with his wife Carrie in Indianapolis. There he practiced law and worked a second job as a court crier that paid $2.50 a day. The couple had a son and daughter. A third child died in infancy, and Harrison made important political connections. When the Civil War came, Harrison was a colonel in the infantry, fighting at Atlanta and Nashville and earning a promotion to brigadier general. Returning as a war hero, Harrison nevertheless lost a race for the governorship of Indiana in 1876, But 4 years later, he was elected by the state legislature to the U.S. Senate. Garfield offered him a cabinet spot, but he declined because he had just taken his seat as a senator. From the floor of the upper house, he impressed the Republican hierarchy with his stinging criticisms of Cleveland. When James G. Blaine refused to be the Republican candidate in 1888, Harrison's name came forward as having the prerequisite military and political experience. Republican Interlude. Whereas Grover Cleveland had antagonized many Democrats in his first term, Harrison ran a remarkably error-free campaign. Running from his front porch in Indianapolis, where he granted interviews and spoke to the more than 300,000 people who came to see him, Harrison emphasized the tariff. As had been the case 4 years earlier, the margin of victory in 1888 was remarkably slim. For example, Harrison received only 2,300 more votes in his home state than had Cleveland, who lost Connecticut by 336 votes. In the end, Cleveland learned the hard way that America is a republic, not a democracy. He won the popular vote, but Harrison became president with a majority in the Electoral College. This also happened in 1824, 1876, and 2000. The electoral situation in America was as follows. The two parties geographically split the nation east of the Mississippi. Whereas Republicans could count on the votes of freedmen, a shrinking vote because of intimidation, literacy tests, and poll taxes in the South, the Democrats in the North drew support from city immigrants, debtor groups angry at hard money, and from labor. Cleveland had offended the second group of Democratic voters with his monetary policies, throwing a wild card into the deck. With this sectional division from 1876 to 1896, the West, including parts of the old Northwest, as well as the new Plains areas and Pacific states, became the fulcrum on which elections swung. Historian Paul Kleppner has pinned down the swing areas to specific counties within some of these states, and further identified the source of change as essentially religious between Catholics and two variants of Lutherans. No doubt these ethno-cultural factors existed, but probably they shaped and were shaped by other important views. The fact was, white Southerners wanted nothing to do with the Party of Emancipation, and freedmen and veterans of the Union Army would never vote for the Democrats. That put each election into the hands of farmers and immigrants who saw much to applaud and condemn in each party. Republicans still stood for the tariff and the gold standard, which seemed oppressive to low-income groups. Democrats wanted cheap money, which frightened Eastern businessmen. Each party contained advocates of patronage reform. Thus, the elections were close, contested, and often came down to which candidate had the best party machine in key states on election day. Harrison, therefore, entered the presidency, as had many of his immediate predecessors, without a clear mandate. In 1889, the Republicans had a 10-seat advantage in the Senate and a bare 12-seat majority in the House. Harrison's cabinet, entirely Presbyterian, with four Missourians and several war heroes, was politically obscure. Worse, he had ignored the party bosses, touching off an immediate battle between Congress and the president over spoils. When considering John Hay, Lincoln's private secretary, for an appointment, Harrison observed, "This would be a fine appointment, but there isn't any politics in it." Seeking to sustain the patronage reforms, Harrison placed Theodore Roosevelt on the Civil Service Commission, whereupon the New Yorker promptly irritated and aggravated his fellow members with his energetic but abrasive style. As president, Harrison hoped to restrain the growth of government. But his administration overall constituted a remarkable inversion of the party's positions. He signed the inflammatory Sherman Silver Purchase Act and enthusiastically supported the Sherman Antitrust Act, both signed in July 1890. This was ironic in that Grover Cleveland, Harrison's Democratic opponent, essentially supported the gold standard and was more favorable toward business than Harrison. Yet neither bill's passage came as a surprise. Sherman's antitrust legislation had overwhelming support, 52-1 in the Senate, and passed without dissent in the House. The bill lacked specifics, which was common in state antitrust law and corporate regulation, but it played to the public's demand that government do something about unfair business practices. Yet backers of the Sherman Act, with language prohibiting combinations in restraint of trade and its focus on the trust as a business organization, unwittingly placed more power than ever in the hands of big business. Since the railroad age, businesses had grown by attracting capital through sales of stocks. Multiplying the number of stockholder owners, in turn, required that professional managers take over the operations of the companies. Obsessed with efficiency and cost control, which then meant profits, the managers looked for ways to essentially guarantee prices. They tried a number of unsuccessful forms, including pools, whereby competitors would jointly contribute to a member who agreed to maintain a higher price, but who lost money doing so, and territorial enforcement of markets, in which members would agree not to compete past certain geographic boundaries. Then there was the famous horizontal combination, which is the form of business most people associate with monopoly control. Under a horizontal combination, a competitor seeks to eliminate all other firms in the field. Rockefeller's Standard Oil was accused of acquiring competing refineries to achieve such a monopoly. Unfortunately for the monopolists, but luckily for the public, none of these arrangements ever achieved anything but the most temporary gains. At the time that Rockefeller's Standard Oil controlled upward of 90% of the refining capacity, oil prices were steadily falling. If there was a theoretical monopoly price to be gained, no company in the late 1800s had successfully demonstrated it in practice, and certainly none had capitalized on one through higher prices. Indeed, the best evidence that none of these arrangements worked is that firms had to constantly keep coming up with other gimmicks. One of the most hated was the trust company, the brainchild of Standard Oil attorney S.C.T. Dodd, who suggested using a standard legal fiduciary device to manage the property of another to trade stock in a voting trust. In a trust arrangement, a company creates a new business organization that exchanges shares of its trust certificates for shares in the stock of the acquired companies. Essentially, smaller businesses give 100% control of their company to a trust in return for trust certificates of equal value. The owners of any new firms the trust company acquires do not lose money but do lose control. Standard Oil formed its trust in Ohio in 1879, and within 3 years, 40 companies had exchanged their stock for Standard Oil trust shares. It was all quite reasonable to Rockefeller. Soon, large-scale trusts existed in almost every manufacturing industry, including sugar, whiskey, paint, lead, and petroleum. To legislators, this apparatus seemed dishonest and shifty, a mere paper creation to hide control by wealthy monopolists. Congress thus felt compelled to pass the Sherman Act to constrain these entities, at which time corporations merely turned to another form of organization called a holding company, which acquired special chartering legislation from the state government that many trusts lacked, allowing one company to hold stock in another. New Jersey liberalized its general incorporation laws in 1889, permitting companies to hold other companies, even if the held companies were located in other states. Within a decade, several companies established themselves in New Jersey, including the newly recapitalized Standard Oil. Long before that, however, professional managers had already started to abandon the horizontal combination and the trust in favor of yet another, far more efficient and profitable structure, the vertical combination. Rather than concerning themselves with competitors, the vertical combinations focused exclusively on achieving efficiencies in their own products by acquiring sources of raw materials, transportation, warehousing, and sales. Standard Oil, for example, not only had its own oil in the ground, but also made its own barrels, refined the oil itself, had its own railroad cars and ships, and literally controlled the oil from the ground to its final form as refined kerosene. Similarly, Gustavus Swift, the meat packer, owned his own cattle ranches, transportation networks, slaughterhouses, refrigerated railroad cars, and even wholesale meat distributors. Managers could take advantage of the top-to-bottom control to reduce costs and, above all, plan for the acquisition of new raw materials and factories. In the 1890s, the Sherman Act was only marginally employed against corporations, but as it came into use, it drove firms out of the inefficient trusts and into the more efficient vertical combinations. With trusts prohibited, even those firms not inclined to adopt vertical combinations abandoned other forms of organization. Sherman, paradoxically, forced American business into an organizational structure that made it larger and more powerful than it otherwise would have been, funneling the corporation into the most efficient form it could possibly take, making the average industrial firm several times larger than if it had adopted either a horizontal combination or a trust structure. Thanks to Sherman, American industry embarked on the first great merger wave toward truly giant-sized companies. The most famous of these was Morgan's reorganization of Carnegie Steel, which, when merged with John Warren Gates's American Wire Company and other smaller businesses, became U.S. Steel, the world's first billion-dollar corporation. Most of the mergers took place under the administration of McKinley, but it was the Sherman Act that had slammed shut alternative paths. Meanwhile, Sherman's other bill, the Silver Purchase Act, was nearly fatal to the nation's economy in Harrison's tenure. Sherman authorized the government to purchase 4.5 million ounces of silver a month at the stipulated price of 16.5 to 1. Not enough to ensure the inflation the silverites wanted, but just enough to turn the arbitrageurs loose. Over the subsequent 3 years, the government purchased $147 million worth of silver, often paying for it in gold, bringing into play Gresham's Law, which postulated that bad money drives out good. Pro-silver forces set into motion a dynamic of arbitrage that would encourage speculators to exchange cheap silver for undervalued gold. Harrison would escape blame for the brunt of the damage which occurred under the unfortunate Cleveland's second term, but he had released the demons of instability and uncertainty. One of Harrison's most successful programs involved his rebuilding of U.S. naval power. When Harrison took office, a series of modern steel cruisers had been authorized in 1885 by Congress, the so-called ABCD ships, Atlanta, Boston, Chicago, and Dolphin, to supplement 5 medium-sized cruisers, 2 large cruisers, and 2 battleships. But at the time Harrison assumed office, only the Atlanta and Boston were seaworthy, and soon the nation was stunned by a major storm that devastated 3 ships, or 10% of the active fleet, including the Trenton, the Navy's newest vessel aside from the ABCD ships. Brigadier General Benjamin Franklin Tracy, the Secretary of the Navy, took the initiative to reinvigorate the Navy, beginning with support for the Naval War College and naming Alfred Thayer Mahan as its president. As soon as the Chicago became operational, Tracy had its squadron perform in several displays designed to raise public awareness and generate congressional support. Even so, the United States with the new cruisers would be, at best, the 12th ranked naval power in the world, behind powerhouses like Chile and Turkey. Independent of the Department of the Navy, a commission called the Naval Policy Board had come to similar conclusions, advocating a navy that would rank second only to Great Britain's. The result was the Naval Act of 1890, which authorized the Indiana, Massachusetts, and Oregon, all 10,000-ton battleships supplemented with other large cruisers. To meet the new demand, the Navy negotiated a contract with Carnegie Steel for armor plating. Although Congress did not fund every ship, by 1899, Harrison had jumped the U.S. Navy up to the sixth position in the world, behind the traditional European powers of Great Britain, France, Russia, Italy, and Germany. Within just a few more years, new construction programs would lift the American fleet up to the second spot, just behind Britain. Seed corn and Cleveland's return. Harrison might have won re-election if he'd had only the sour economy to contend with. Other factors worked in favor of Cleveland, who squared off against him again. The summer of 1892 brought several bloody strikes, including the Coeur d'Alene violence in Idaho and the Homestead strike. Despite Harrison's pro-silver attitudes, the cheap money forces were not assuaged. The McKinley Tariff alienated Southerners and Westerners. The Sherman Act had laid the groundwork for upheaval in the economy. The Populist Party nominated James B. Weaver of Iowa, who received 1 million votes. In an election decided by 380,000 votes out of 10.6 million, the populists split the silver vote enough to ensure Cleveland's election. In the Electoral College, Cleveland's victory was more pronounced. Harrison spent his final months unsuccessfully attempting to annex Hawaii. Harrison had pushed the United States onto the world stage, a position it would grab enthusiastically in 1898. In office for the second time, Cleveland again proved a model of character and firmness on issues. His seed corn veto, a prime act of political courage in that he had everything to gain by signing it and nothing to lose, blocked the provision of millions of dollars in loans for Midwestern farmers to buy seed. Cleveland said that no such federal power was sanctioned by the Constitution. Private charity should take care of the farmers, he argued. And it did. Private organizations raised many times the amount that the feds would have provided. Cleveland, nonetheless, failed to contain the bloating federal bureaucracy. By the time William McKinley entered the White House, Cleveland's administration had seen the number of civil service jobs doubled. Whether or not the new professional civil servants were more qualified, the Pendleton Act had dramatically increased their ranks. Of more immediate concern to Cleveland was the massive gold drain and collapse in railroad stocks, which sent the economy into a full-fledged panic in 1893. In a month, one-fourth of the nation's railroads had met with financial disaster, dissipating $2.5 billion in capital and sending waves through the economy that culminated in more than 2 million unemployed. More than 600 banks failed, along with mines, factories, and brokerage houses. At the peak of the Depression, Jacob Coxey, an Ohio reformer, set out from Massillon, Ohio, with 20,000 marchers for Washington, although some came from as far away as the West Coast. They planned to stage a protest at the nation's capital. The hungry soldiers in Coxey's army descended on Washington and attempted to force their way into the Capitol, whereupon police charged and scattered the marchers. To continue paying artificially high prices for silver threatened to bankrupt the U.S. Treasury. Cleveland therefore called a special session of Congress for the purpose of repealing the Sherman Silver Purchase Act. Silver interests demonized Cleveland. Pitchfork Ben Tillman, a fellow Democrat campaigning for the Senate, called Cleveland an old bag of beef, who was acting worse than when Judas betrayed Christ. Only later was Cleveland praised by the press for standing firm on gold. Although the Silver Act was repealed, outstanding silver notes continued to be presented for redemption in gold. In 1892, the U.S. gold reserve was $84 million, but by 1894, it had fallen to $69 million. It appeared the economy might stagger to a recovery when, in 1895, a new panic swept through the banking community. More than $20 million in gold had flowed out of the treasury in just over a week. To the rescue rode Morgan. He had spoken by telephone to Cleveland about a massive loan to the government when the president mentioned that there was only $9 million left in the New York sub-treasury. Morgan, through his sources, was aware of a large $10 million draft about to be presented for payment, which essentially would have put the U.S. government in default. A default would have triggered a nationwide panic and essentially bankrupted the government. Morgan recommended immediately forming a syndicate with European bankers to buy 3.5 million ounces of gold for $65 million in long-term bonds. For literally saving the national economy, Morgan and Cleveland were both heaped with abuse. Morgan for the profits he made, approximately $7 million, and Cleveland for having cut a deal with the gold devil. Lost in the debate was the fact that Morgan was already wealthy, and the collapse of the U.S. government would have only inconvenienced him. He could have sailed for England or France with his remaining fortune. Instead, he acted in concert with a sensible president to save the country from the Silverites' idiocy. The economy and the silver issue dominated the National Party's conventions in 1896. Silver Democrats continued to heap scorn on Cleveland, with Tillman taking the Senate floor to call him a besotted tyrant. Whatever hopes Cleveland had of running for a third term were dashed at the Democratic convention in Chicago, where the Cleveland supporters saw the streets lined with crowds sporting silver badges and waving silver banners. A new star now took the political stage, Congressman William Jennings Bryan of Nebraska. Bryan had run for the U.S. Senate in 1894 and been defeated, but he had used his time out of politics to reach wide audiences on the Chautauqua speaking circuit. A devout Christian and stirring orator, Bryan captivated the 1896 Democratic Convention with his famous Cross of Gold speech, in which he used the metaphor of Christ's crucifixion to describe America's enslavement to hard money. The convention voted 2-1 for a plank calling for taking the country off the gold standard. It sickened Cleveland, who years later still referred to Bryanism. "I do not regard it as democracy," he told a reporter. Cleveland's departure from American politics ensured a string of defeats for the Democrats, and he was the last small government candidate the Democrats would ever run. Inching toward a modern America. Harrison and Cleveland saw innumerable changes in the nation in their combined 12-year tenure. By the time of Cleveland's second term, telephones were widely available, although the president still functioned without a full-time operator, instead relying on a telegrapher assigned to the chief executive. Most of the daily executive office work was carried out by three clerks, a pair of doormen, and a handful of military aides and attachés. Harrison met with his cabinet twice a week, but the days when a president could run the government single-handedly from the White House were all but gone. Something else had passed, too. The Civil War generation had largely disappeared during Harrison's term. In 1893 alone, David Porter, Lincoln's former vice president Hannibal Hamlin, Supreme Court Justice Lucius Q.C. Lamar, James Blaine, and Rutherford Hayes all died. In their place came a new generation of politicians, including Teddy Roosevelt, William Jennings Bryan, and Woodrow Wilson, and industrialists like Henry Ford, Henry Leland, and Billy Durant, all born during or after the Civil War and too young to remember it. For this generation, waving the bloody shirt would not only prove ineffective, at least in the North, but it would also appear to many Americans as anachronistic. William McKinley was perhaps the first president ever to even obliquely appreciate the staggering changes that had occurred. He captured the direction of the new reality with his pithy campaign slogan, "A Full Dinner Pail." Far from the end of the Van Buren-originated spoils system, the post-Pendleton era in American politics marked a malignant mutation of the concept of patronage, pushing it down one level further directly to the voters themselves. Chapter 13. Building Best, Building Greatly, 1896 to 1912. Average Americans at the turn of the century. A popular 1901 magazine, Current Literature, collated available census data about American males at the turn of the century. It reported that the typical American man was British by ancestry with traces of German, was 5'9" tall, or about 2 inches taller than average European males, and had 3 living children and 1 who had died in infancy. A Protestant, the average American male was a Republican, subscribed to a newspaper, and lived in a 2-story, 7-room house. His estate was valued at about $5,000, of which $750 was in a bank account or other equities. He drank more than 7 gallons of liquor a year, consumed 75 gallons of beer, and smoked 20 pounds of tobacco. City males earned about $750 a year, farmers about $550, and they paid only 3% of their income in taxes. Compared to their European counterparts, Americans were vastly better off, leading the world with a per capita income of $227 as opposed to the British male's $181 and a Frenchman's $161, partially because of lower taxes. British men paid 9% of their income and the French 12%. Standard income for industrial workers averaged $559 per year. Gas and electricity workers earned $543 per year, and even lower-skilled labor was receiving $484 a year. Of course, people in unusual or exceptional jobs could make a lot more money. Actress Sarah Bernhardt in 1906 earned $1 million for her movies, and heavyweight boxer Jack Johnson took home a purse of $5,000 when he won the heavyweight boxing championship of 1908. Even more normal, yet still specialized, jobs brought high earnings. The manager of a farm implement department could command $2,000 per year in 1905, or an actuary familiar with Western insurance could make up to $12,000 annually, according to ads in the New York Times. What did that buy? An American in 1900 spent $30 a year on clothes, $82 for food, $4 for doctors and dentists, and gave $9 to religion and welfare. A statistic that might horrify modern listeners, however, shows that tobacco expenditures average